Hi, this is Martin Willis in the Antique Auction Podcast Show. We're here doing a segment today on early American and European pewter with one of the country's premier dealers, Wayne Hilt. Hi, Wayne. How are you?
I'm fine, Martin. You?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Okay, this is a very interesting segment, I think, of the business. Can you give us... let's just start out. Can you give us an overall known history of pewter?
Well, pewter first began, from what we can determine, in England via the Romans who had settled there in the early 200s. And they discovered the tin mines apparently in Cornwall and began to mine tin and produce pewter, of which tin is the primary element. There have been many pieces of Roman pewter that have been excavated in digs in England, and many of these exist in museums in that country as well as others.
Oh, now what is another composition of besides tin in pewter?
Well, tin is the primary element of all pewter.
Uh-huh.
There were several different types of pewter that were made. There was hard metal, there was lay metal, and then there was trifling metal. The lower quality pewter, which was used for plumbing fixtures and things like measures in which liquid would be stored for just a brief moment, did contain sometimes a considerable amount of lead. The better quality metals contained very little lead. In fact, some of the hard metals contain no lead at all. There also is antimony, bismuth, bits of copper, and other trace elements that are found naturally within the various elements. People always query as to the problem with lead in pewter, and once a metal has been alloyed, it is reluctant to give up its component parts. So that unless somebody was storing a highly acidic substance like red wine in pewter containing a lot of lead, the leaching effect would be minimal.
So it's a kind of a misconception that when people were eating from pewter and drinking from pewter that it was poisonous?
Well, yes, it is a misconception. I have personally been working with pewter since around 1970, and I've had heavy metal tests run when I had a blood test, and I've shown absolutely no sign of elevation of lead in my system from working with pewter.
Do you think part of the misconception is that because pewter looks like lead and it's kind of heavy and dense?
That could be part of it, but there is a bit of truth to the fact there is back in Rome, the wealthy Romans did store their wine in lead casks. And not pewter casks, but casks made out of pure lead. And as a result, they ended up with lead poisoning.
I see, And they actually called it lead poisoning back then?
I have no idea what they called it.
But they were aware that it was from the containers?
The Romans weren't, because they continued to use it.
Okay.
As far as the English were very cognizant of, I believe, of the problems of lead, and that the guilds in England, particularly in London, had very stringent rules concerning the alloys that people used. In fact, the guilds would send inspectors around to various shops, and they'd take a piece of finished material off the shelf, and they would melt it down, and they had molds into which they would pour the metal that they had melted, which would form a disc, a coin-shaped disc of a specific size. And they would weigh it, and if it did not weigh within the parameters that they had set up for this particular alloy, they would confiscate the goods of the pewterer and fine him.
Is that right? You know, that's very sophisticated for back then.
We have a tendency to think that in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, that things were not all that sophisticated. I believe that quite the opposite was true, that the quality of the workmanship, the molds, the metal, and business practices were every bit as complex as we see today, and that there were great interrelationships between pewterers as they depended upon each other for the whole product to be saleable everywhere.
Well, I know things are just done in a different way, but that's pretty amazing. So what began your, you said since 1970, so that's going way back. What sparked your initial interest in pewter?
Well, I have to admit my initial interest in pewter began as my parents were collectors.
Oh.
My father was a noted researcher of pewter, particularly the pewterers who worked in Connecticut. In fact, Ledley Laughlin used a lot of my father's research material in his third volume, A History of American Pewter, and the author John Carl Thomas wrote a book on Connecticut pewter and pewterers, which would not have been able to be written without my father's research.
Wow.
So, naturally, you know, Mom and Dad ran around to antique shops, and at a very young age, at the age of 10, I actually began to collect pewter. I was buying pewter from Carl Jacobs, who was one of the premier dealers in antique pewter in the 1950s and 60s.
Wow, that's amazing. So speaking of dealers, I remember a great collector named Webster Goodwin.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he was. Was he out in Rhode Island or something like that?
Yeah, Webb lived in Warwick, Rhode Island. He was, at one time, he was the president of the Pewter Collectors Club of America.
Yeah.
Webb collected, leaning his collection heavily into the area of Rhode Island pewter.
Oh, I see. He was a great guy, I remember.
A substantial portion of his collection he sold to, I believe it's a university in Rhode Island, and it's all his Newport pewter.
Oh, I see. Wow. Yeah. Wow. All right. So, anyway, what's up? Are there some, like, big names in, you're calling them pewterers.
Right.
That's kind of a hard word to say, but are there some big names in, so let's just talk about American names.
Well, in pewter, probably the, I should say, never mind, probably, the, in American pewter, the most famous pewterer is a fellow by the name of William Will. William Will was the son of John Will, who had emigrated to America around 1752 and set up shop in New York City. William had several brothers who were also involved in the business, one by the name of Henry and the other named Philip.
The signer of the Declaration?
Pardon me?
Signer of the Declaration?
No.
No, okay. Wasn't there a... I'm sorry, I'm confusing with someone else.
Yeah. Philip okay. Will, or William Will, excuse me, was a colonel in the American Revolution.
Oh, okay.
He also was the high sheriff of the city of Philadelphia, and very much involved in politics and government.
Hmm.
He also was one of the most accomplished pewterers who lived in America, producing a wide range of forms from spoons to some of the most marvelous and magnificent church flagons you could imagine.
Wow.
There are other, as I just mentioned, the Will family, there were several other families that were of great note in American pewter. In Boston in the 17th century, there was a family by the name of Dolbear. The eldest Dolbear emigrated from England, and they made pewter in the 17th century, of which there are probably around a dozen to 18 examples extant of the workmanship of these men, and they're totally known by their flatware, which we refer to as plates, dishes, and basins. Unlike silver, where flatware is thought of as being forks, knives, and spoons.
Right, wow.
But also in Connecticut, we have the famous families of the Danforths and the Boardmans. The Danforths were, you know, a very large family that produced pewter from the mid-18th century right into the mid-19th century, and the Boardmans primarily produced pewter in Hartford from the beginning of the 19th century through about 1868. Then in New York City, we also have the Wills again. We also have another family, the Bradfords, and then a more famous family, the Bassetts. All of these families were very much involved in the trade. They had numbers of family members, usually spanning several generations, who were involved in the business.
Okay, I've seen the name Bassett on silver. Were some of these pewterers also silversmiths, or did they just stick to pewter?
Well, I have heard that one pewterer, Israel Trask, a pewterer in Beverly, Massachusetts, was trained as a silversmith, but all the work that we know by him is strictly in pewter. So as far as any crossover, I know of none.
I see. Now, is this something that was usually done? You mentioned families. So is it usually something that was like passed down from one generation, the trade?
Oh, absolutely. We'll take the Danforth family, for example. Thomas Danforth II began his career in Middletown, Connecticut, working from about 1755 until his death in 1782. He had a substantial family, many of whom were involved in the pewtering trade. He had a whole slew of sons and one daughter. And the sons, he had the son Thomas III, and I actually should back up a teeny bit, is that Thomas II was the son of Thomas I, who had moved from Taunton, Mass. To Norwich, Connecticut. Thomas II had a brother, John, who was also a pewterer. They were likely trained by their father, but the quality of Thomas II's work is so intense that it stands to reason that he perhaps received some additional training elsewhere. My father always thought that perhaps he went to England for a brief while to learn the trade, but there's no evidence that that actually happened. But Thomas II had the following sons. He had Thomas III. He had a son, Joseph. Another one, Edward, Jonathan, William, Samuel. The daughter's name was Sarah, and she married into the Boardman family. They ended up producing three sons who were involved in the business. One was Thomas Danforth Boardman, his brother Sherman Boardman, and a younger brother Timothy Boardman. That generation carried on another generation. Sherman had a son named Henry S. Boardman who was working in the mid-19th century. Now, both the number of the boys all had children who were involved in the pewtering trade. Thomas III had a son, Thomas IV, who worked from about 1806 to 18. He also had a daughter whose name was Hannah, who married a man named Richard Williams, who was a brazier. They had a son named Otis Williams, who was also a pewterer, and William Danforth had a son, Josiah Danforth, who actually got trained by his, I guess it'd be his uncle, Thomas Danforth Boardman, and he ended up going off on his own and was a major producer of pewter in Middletown.
Now, sometimes you think a lot of times of like a monumental piece of silver, but you mentioned earlier the church flagons that were monumental. So were there like really amazing pieces created in pewter?
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely. They're probably considered the most iconic piece of pewter that was made by any American pewter are the 18th century federal-style coffee pots that were produced by William Will. There are several of these pictures in Charles Montgomery's book, History of American Pewter, that features a lot of the items in the possession of Winnather Museum, and then there's also one or two that are pictured in Ledley Laughlin's volumes. I believe one's pictured in Volume 2, and a very important one on a square flint face is pictured in Volume 3. These are high-style Philadelphia coffee pots of the most elegant design, featuring an urn-shaped body with a gooseneck-type spout, beautiful wood handles. They're usually beaded around the outermost edges of the piece, and they're just elegant.
Wow. Now, was there any casting done with pewter? I just don't know how that...
Well, pewter is primarily made by casting in molds. A lot of people will look at a piece of pewter and they'll see turning lines and they'll say, oh, it's spun.
Well,
there's a difference between casting and spinning. When you cast an object in a mold, it comes out to the shape that you want it to be. When you spin something, you take a sheet of metal and you force it using a highly polished steel tool over a wooden form or other type of material to attain the shape that you wish. There's an easy way for a beginning collector to tell whether a piece of pewter is cast or it's spun. If you take a cast plate, for example, and you hold it by the edge and you tap the plate with your fingernail, you'll have a definite ring to the metal. It has a clarity to this ring that is very distinct.
Really?
On the other hand, if you were to take a plate that was spun up out of sheet metal and do the same thing, it's a dull thud.
Like a thunk, yeah.
Yep, it's a distinct difference between the two. However, spinning was something that was primarily came into being in the early to mid-19th century, and it was used by a number of makers, including people like Roswell Gleason, Leonard Reedon Barton, the Taunton Britannia Manufacturing Company, and others. However, all of those people also made substantial portions of the parts for, say, a coffee pot or teapot by either casting or stamping. They did drop stamps, just like we would do drop forging today with steel. All cast pewter had to be finished, and that was finished on a lathe. They would hold the piece in place over a form to keep it from distorting, and they would using a cleaning tool, which would actually scrape the surface of the metal, in a very similar method to the way a woodworker would turn down a piece of wood. You'd end up cleaning off the rough surface of the casting and come down to a smooth surface. The surface would probably be further cleaned by burnishing to enhance the surface and make it bright.
Now
most pieces are made up of multiple parts, and they were put together in various ways. Some involved a fused solder method, which involved holding the two pieces together, holding a piece of cloth to the inside of the piece, and running a hot soldering iron around the joint on the outside. Another method was what they call sweat soldering, where the two pieces were held together usually with wire or clamps, and a solder, which melted at a lower temperature, was placed in the joint between the two parts. And it was heated with a blowpipe being blown over an alcohol lamp. And this would allow the lower melting solder to melt prior to the pewter itself melting. And a flux was used so that the solder, once it was melted, would flow evenly around the joint, making for a very tight and strong bond.
Let's talk about, I think of pewter, a lot of times I see pewter was probably very well used. It's all a lot of beat up pieces. Does pewter just plain wear out totally?
Well, pewter is one of the first recyclables. In old advertisements we see in newspapers, we frequently run across ads by pewterers, and they always have a nota beta at the end. The said pewter will take in old pewter towards new. And it, unlike your car that has generally a poor trade-in value, pewter had a really great trade-in value, as the cost of most objects in the 18th century and into the beginning of the 19th century was the cost of the product material itself. So if you needed eight new plates and you had eight old plates and you brought the eight old plates into the pewter, you probably would get six new ones for a trade-in and only have to buy two.
How about that?
And this is one of the reasons that early stuff is far more scarce than later stuff is, because it was recycled.
How about that? That's interesting. So are you a collector as well as a dealer?
Yes, I have an interest in English export pewter.
Oh, really? Wow.
We oftentimes forget that we were colonies and that the majority of the goods that we received, other than what was produced in this country, came from England. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the export of pewter to America exceeded in pounds sterling all other exports that were sent here from England.
Really? Wow.
And in the 1760s, well in excess of 22,000 pounds sterling were shipped to this country annually.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the value of pewter at that time, what pewter, finished pewter cost, if you were to take all the pewter that was sent here during any one year during the 1760s, melt it down and make nothing but 8-inch plates out of it, you would produce over 1 million 8-inch plates with that amount of metal. And that one has to consider at a time when the population of the United States or colonies was less than 3 million people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there any modern-day pewter makers that really take pride in their work and try to make
it? There are several. In fact, there's one couple that produces pewter who are actually descendants of the Danforths.
Oh, wow.
It's Fred and Judy Danforth, and they're up in Middlebury, Vermont. They produce pewter, but they have a tendency to make things that are more contemporary as compared to some of the other modern pewterers who produce things of more traditional form.
Mm-hmm.
Two men who produce things in traditional form, however, the majority of the stuff that they make is not cast but is spun, but yet they're copying forms of 18th and early 19th century design. One man is a fellow by the name of John Gibson, who's up in Hillsborough, New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, here's a generational thing. He was trained by his father,
mm-hmm.
who was also a pewter. And there's another fellow by the name of Richard Graver, who is down in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Both of these guys make traditional forms, including things like 18th century pear-shaped teapots and cream pitchers and plates and porringers and all the forms that one would expect to see produced by an 18th century pewterer.
Uh-huh. You know, one thing I've always, when people always like listen to shows like this, one thing they always want to find out is in regards to money, what something's worth. What would you consider the amount, dollar amount, of the most monumental piece you've ever seen come up?
Well, the most monumental piece I've ever seen come up was a William Will coffee pot that sold at a Northeast auction.
Oh, yeah.
One that belonged to Ledley Laughlin, and I believe, including the buyer's premium, exceeded $240,000.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing.
Well, Martin, I'd like to bring up a point here. Is that,
sure.
You know, we always like to see or hear about all the flashbang of
yeah.
the high-end things.
That's right.
And I was recently talking to one of the reporters for the Maine Antique Digest, and I said, you know, the more people talk about all the high-end things, the more it would discourage a beginning collector from collecting, because if all they read about or hear about are high-end things, then they get discouraged and say, why would I even want to bother? Because, you know, this thing sold for $50,000 and that thing sold for $75,000.
Yeah.
And I'd have to eat beans for 6 years to be able to afford to buy that. But pewter is one thing that was made in quantity.
Mm-hmm.
And like many other areas of collectibles and antiques, there's an awful lot that's actually quite affordable to the beginning collector. And I'm talking
sure.
about things that are in excellent condition.
Mm-hmm.
As with all antiques, it's condition, condition, condition.
Right.
If you're looking for a William Will coffee pot and one comes along and it's a little tired and it's not priced that kind of money that we had mentioned earlier, you might want to consider it because the chances of finding another one are very, very slim. On the other hand, there are a lot of what we call initial-handled porringers that were made in New England that have raised cast initials on the back of the handle. And these are relatively common. and that if you wanted to get one, one would be advised to wait till you found one in fine condition, because they frequently can be bought from anywhere between $300 and $600 each, which is a very affordable price for an 18th century object in fine condition. And it's also a good starting point for a collector. You know, I don't know if you collect, but most collectors that I've talked to, I always ask them, so what was the first thing you bought that cost you more than a week's pay? And they remember it, because it was a decision that took a bit of pondering, because it was a step up from buying something that was $30 or $40 that they'd spend on a tank of gas.
Right, right. Wow. Now, are there, as far as giving advice to a novice collector, is there any particular books or anything like that that would be good
stuff? Well, yes, there is. There's a couple of things that all beginning collectors who have any remote interest in being seriously interested in the field of collecting antique pewters, is that there's an organization called the Pewter Collectors Club of America. They publish two bulletins a year, and they also put out two newsletters. The bulletins generally contain articles written by members of the club, and some outside articles have been submitted that talk about various topics on pewter. May have some new forms by a particular maker, something about pewtering techniques. There might be an article of a very rare piece that might show up, or some discussion as to comparing same type objects made by different makers. So it's full of interesting articles, and they are well written and very informative. The club also has meetings that we hold in various areas of the country. We just had our 75th anniversary meeting, and an exhibit was held at the Brandywine River Museum in Chads Fort, Pennsylvania. Also, the club published in 2006, and I was one of the co-authors of a very informative book, Collecting Antique Pewter, What to Look For and What to Avoid. This is available through various bookstores, and it's also a bonus if you join the club.
Oh, that's nice.
And the book covers. First, the book was written as a commemoration of the late John Carl Thomas, who I mentioned earlier had written the book Connecticut Pewter and Pewterers. And John had actually started the organization to obtain fakes and forgeries for the purposes of educating people that these do exist.
Now, let's stop right there for a second. So, have people taken, like, for instance, a pewter tankard in early, like, 18th century, and then stamp a hallmark on to fake it? Well, how do they fake it?
Well, there's various types of fakes. There's pieces that are made in their entirety by people, sometimes using old molds, and they have fake dyes that they use that they strike copies of makers' marks. Huh. There are also cases where people will take a genuine mark and cut it out of a junk piece of pewter and insert it into another piece.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
There were a number of fakers in England who were working fairly early on, and some of the fakes that they have made have, you know, over the years have deteriorated to the point that people just look at it, oh, this has to be correct.
When you say early on, do you mean in the 19th century?
Well, it probably in the 1920s, so that's you know, almost 100 years ago now.
Yeah.
But just a little bit further on the book covers how pewter was made. It shows construction and fabrication techniques, and it's well illustrated, so people have a terrific idea how things were made. It talks about connoisseurship and collecting, and it talks about form, which is something that is important in any area of collecting. There are certain forms that people gravitate to, and style and design, which it's easy to recognize good design versus bad design. And then, of course, we talk about various periods, you know, early things versus things that are of later manufacture. as well as topics like rarity. The discussion is made on the function of pieces of pewter. Pewter was used for everything. There were baby bottles, there were spoons, there were invalid feeders, there were bedpans, there were infusion mugs, which is an 18th century version of a modern-day vaporizer. There were lamps, both for oil and fluid, basins, bowls, porringers, dishes, mugs, tankards, flagons, chalices, baptismal bowls. There are just a wide range of forms by a wide range of makers made in numerous countries and Europe. My gosh, there were tens and tens of thousands of pewterers working in Europe. Very little of that was exported to this country. A good deal was brought over by Germanic families and French families when they immigrated to this country, but I've seen very little evidence that any was actually exported to America, whereas with England, it was a mainstay.
Now, you mentioned earlier about if someone gets a chance to find a William Will a coffee urn or coffee pot for a good deal and it's in rough condition, then they probably should buy it. If you do find something like that in rough condition, is there any type of restoration that can be done to something?
Oh, yeah. There are, first off, there's very few people who are capable of doing the restoration. I'm one of the few. There are many people who claim to do restoration, but the workmanship is less than it should be. And as is the case with any restoration, the quality of the restoration is paramount to what the piece is and should be. Pewter's one of the wonderful objects that actually can be restored quite successfully, providing that the damage is not too severe. However, in, you know, in some cases, I restored for a church that had had a lid lost on a flagon in a fire. I restored the entire lid and thumb piece, and it, to an untrained eye, it would be basically impossible to tell the two apart.
Wow. Now, would pewter make it through a fire?
Well, it depends upon how hot a fire is. Pewter melts at a fairly low temperature of around between 5 and 700 degrees, depending on the alloy. The lid had fallen off on this one as somebody was taking it out of the church before the church burnt to the ground.
Wow.
But pewter, I in fact bought a collection from someone that had had a fire, but fortunately the majority of the damage was smoke because there were only a few pieces that started to melt. But if somebody was to have a major fire, it would be just blobs on the floor.
It'd go away. Hey, Wayne, we're just about out of time. Can you why don't you give us, throw out your website address?
Okay, it's hiltpewter.com.
And if you just simply go to Google and type in Wayne Hilt Pewter, and your wife Phyllis is also involved too, is that right?
Yes, she is. We both do shows together. We do approximately 4 shows a year, primary in the Northeast.
Yep. Now, you're in Connecticut?
Yes, we are.
And why don't you go ahead and just throw your phone number out there, too.
Okay, it's 860-267-2146.
Great. Okay, Wayne, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today and very informative. Great job. I really really appreciate it and a lot of good information.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Martin. It was good to talk to you.
All right, very good.
Please stay in touch.
I certainly will. Take care now. Yeah, bye-bye. Well, I think that was pretty good. That was Wayne Hilt in Connecticut on American, mostly American, and European pewter we discussed today. And this is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast Show, signing off.